This is a podcast from BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
Hello, you're listening to Beyond the Ballot Box. I'm Darshan Johan. For there to be a proper functioning democracy, we need a proper functioning media system, one that's focused on the democratization of ideas and robust debate between various viewpoints. However, the hyper-commercial media landscape today couldn't be further from that. Fake news, half-truths, narrow perspectives, playing to the gallery and rage-baiting culture wars have greatly contributed to the polarization we see across the world. Peter Beattie, who's a regular guest on this show, wrote a book titled Social Evolution, Political Psychology, and the Media in Democracy, which focuses on problems which the media landscape today is facing and what needs to be done to make it better, which is what we will be unpacking on the show today. As always, this conversation is also available as a podcast. You can find us Beyond the Ballot Box on the BFM app, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts from. Peter, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Darshan.
Let's start with this. What inspired you to write this book?
Well, I guess the inspiration was just going from someone who was raised in a very right-wing, religious fundamentalist family environment, having my ideology challenged by conversations essentially on the internet, getting exposed to very different ideas and finding that my ideology didn't seem to have the best answers, and then having to kind of rebuild an ideology from scratch. And so that made me just incredibly fascinated with the question, why do people believe what they believe about politics? So that was really the core inspiration for me to write the book.
So your book is on the media, but your first chapter of your book is why democracy is not working. What does democracy mean to you, and why do you think it's not working?
Well, what democracy means to me is really the most kind of fundamental or radical understanding of democracy, going back to the very origins of the word. It's a word with basically combining two Greek words, demos, the people, meaning all of the people, and kritia, power. So the implication just from the very word itself is that all of the people share equally in political power. And that, of course, is a kind of ideal that you can't find really anywhere in the world among countries that are called democracies. Because when you look at how public opinion is formed, you don't have that core requirement for a democracy. The people sharing equally in political power. And why is that not present? Because you don't have democracy-appropriate media systems and educational systems that inform the people of the full range of ideologies and the policies that come from them and allow them to deliberate from a basis of full information and then make their own minds.
A short tangent. Do you think people tend to misunderstand what democracy is or what it's supposed to be, at least, instead of looking at it from a position of democratizing political economic power? People look at it that if you have elections, you're democratic. If you have no elections, you're undemocratic. And so people tend to just compare countries like that.
Exactly. I call them, it's a different way of thinking. It's votocracy. As long as there's a vote and anyone could start a party, technically, although to really start a party, you need a massive amount of money. It's just votocracy is being conflated with democracy, and it's not the same. Having the vote only is democratic if you have a democratic formation of public opinion, if people are equally sharing in the power to make up their own minds and convince other people of their beliefs. But for that, you need a democracy-appropriate media and educational system, and that's a rarity in the world.
So again, your book is on the media, but I found it very fascinating that you, very early on, you talk about Darwin, evolution, meme theory. Why did you decide to dive into all of this? Could you unpack this a little bit for me?
Yeah, sure. So I was interested in, as I said, the question, why do people believe what they believe about politics? So I first looked at what any area of science had to say about how the human world came to be populated with such a vast diversity of ideas, ideologies, religions, technologies, languages, etc. How did this species end up becoming so radically different from every other species on Earth? So for that, the only real theory that exists is evolutionary theory to explain both why the biological world came to be full of such a vast assortment of diverse creatures of all sorts, but also the intellectual world. So there's a kind of offshoot of biological evolution called social evolution theory, which is actually almost as old as biological evolution theory itself. As soon as Darwin's book came out, a lot of people, including the late great psychologist William James, noted that it seems like the realm of the intellect is subject to the same basic evolutionary process as the realm of biology. So the social evolution theory is really the only theory that I could find that has anything whatsoever to say about how we came to have such a diverse realm of ideas that we inhabit. So I had to start there and then look at what theories or paradigms in psychology attempt to explain aspects of that reality, the diversity, the incredible diversity of ideas, beliefs, et cetera, that we have. And so there's a social representations theory that studies how combinations of ideas spread throughout society. And when I say combinations of ideas, I'm just talking about, the seminal study in social representations was how Freudian psychology spread throughout French society. And so he looked primarily at different media outlets, like the Catholic media outlets spreading a understanding of Freudianism that was somewhat critical wherever Freudianism contradicted the Catholic religion, but kind of reinterpreted it in a way that was consistent with the Catholic worldview. And then you had the kind of centrist media that just explained the theory as it was understood more or less by its own practitioners. And then you had the communist or Marxist media that spread Freudianism in the form of a critique of Freudianism, that here's this guy saying that if you're poorly adjusted to society, it's your fault. When our point is, it's not your fault that you're having psychological problems. It's the fact that society is poorly structured and we have a different idea. So social representations theory in psychology attempts to explain part of the question. Why are there so many people in any given country who think largely similarly about political ideologies? And the answer coming from social representations theory is largely through, the schools and the media system that people get their information from that result in having a largely similar worldview. And then lastly, schema theory in psychology looks instead at just how the brain processes and stores and uses information. So our brains are not like little computers that, just get the same file that you send me. It's the exact file on my computer as it is in your computer. It's just not the way that our brains work. Instead, we form very idiosyncratic kind of networked structures of schemas. That is, ideas, beliefs, information are stored in our brain in the form of these schemas. And we don't use them in the way a computer does. There's a lot of kind of corruption, if you like, or biases that result from existing schemas, existing ways of thinking about the world, existing beliefs about how the world operates that powerfully affect the way that we process new information and new arguments. So for me, these three areas, social evolution theory, social representations theory, and schema research in psychology are the best answers that science has produced thus far to get to the question or to try to answer the question, why do people believe what they believe about politics?
So the media, how much power does the media have to shape one's beliefs?
An immense amount of power. I compare its power to that of a god. But I point out it's not like the Abrahamic god. It's more like the Hindu or the Greek pantheon of God. So in this metaphor, you have a lot of different forces operating on human minds that influence, you know, the beliefs that they come up with about politics, about religion, about society, gender roles, whatever. Lots and lots of different forces. But among those forces, the news media is the predominant force when it comes to shaping our beliefs about the political realm. And this, you know, you can demonstrate inductively by looking at research showing just how influential the information and the arguments and the narratives we get from the media, how influential they are on what we believe. Or you could just arrive at the same conclusion deductively. That is, ask yourself, how is it possible that any one of us who's not, you know, living at the same time in capital cities around the world and constantly listening in to negotiations between governments, et cetera, how is it possible that we know anything about politics because it's a realm that's so physically distant from us? And of course, the answer is the information that's generated in all of the world's capitals and elsewhere, you know, all of that information that's related to politics, the way that it arrives in our brains is through the kind of logistical transportation network that is the news media.
You know, Peter, most people, I think if you talk to them and ask them, they would think they are believe that they are immune to propaganda, that whatever they are saying is not that they are propagandized to think a certain way, but it is their critical thinking that is leading them to think that way. Are most people immune to propaganda?
It's funny because in a lot of surveys, you find people saying precisely that you know, the media influences other people, or even, you know, TV commercials, they influence other people, but they don't influence me. And I think the reason for that is the same reason that we fail to recognize psychological biases that are operating in our own minds, but we can pick them out in other people more easily. And that is, we don't have a conscious awareness of the biases operating in our minds. They're operating outside of our conscious awareness. And in a roughly similar fashion, the influence that the media has on us is not normally consciously recognized. The feeling of being informed about politics from our media diet is a feeling of simply learning about reality. We're now getting a picture of reality that we're getting from our preferred, you know, media outlets, our media diet. But what we don't see is everything that isn't included. We're radically ignorant of these other narratives that you know, narrative arguments that could be made about the exact same phenomena happening in the world, but we're left completely ignorant of them because they simply aren't in our media diet. So we simply cannot know how our beliefs or opinions might be different if our media diets included these other arguments that are built up out of other bits of information, other facts, other pieces of evidence. If we're never exposed to them, it just feels like we're in the simple process of being informed accurately. And we, of course, have no reason to believe otherwise because we're left ignorant of these contrary narratives that we are not exposed to.
So looking at, you know, the media landscape today, you primarily look at the media landscape in the US, but I think there is a, when we look at the core of it, the ideas and the problems, I think at least the principles of it applies to most parts of the world, with obviously certain changes and nuances. What would you say is the biggest problem with media today?
Oh, that's a tough question to narrow it down to one. But if I had to narrow it down to one, I would say commercialism. Right. The fact that not only in the US, but in much of the world, the media system is predominantly commercial. And that means that the media outlets are owned by private individuals, and they exist in a kind of competitive marketplace in which the business model is attracting viewers to then sell to advertisers. That is, you're not obviously selling the people themselves, you're selling their attention to advertisers. And commercialized media systems that exhibit those characteristics, they're privately owned and they rely for their revenue on ads that are sold to advertisers. That aspect of a media system produces a whole range of biases that affect the supply of information that is then offered to viewers and readers, et cetera. I guess just one quick example of how commercialism works was offered by the great Israeli journalist Gideon Levy in an interview on Democracy Now! Recently, where he was talking about the Israeli media system and its coverage of the genocide in Gaza. And he said, look, your average Israeli who just uses Israeli newspapers, Israeli TV stations, Israeli radio, et cetera, is simply completely unaware of the extent of human suffering in Gaza because it's just not displayed. And he goes on to point out that this is not because the Israeli media system is directly owned and operated and controlled by the government, but rather it's a matter of its commercialized nature. So every single editor or journalist, him or herself, in that system is thinking about what the audience is going to like and what the audience is going to hate. And without needing to be told by some government censor, they can just think on their own, if I show video images or pictures of horrible human suffering in Gaza, that's going to upset our viewers, and they're likely to change the channel or unsubscribe to the newspaper. So that's a great example of one of the key kind of political economic pressures that commercialized media systems have. And it's not the only one, but it's one of the more prominent ones.
On the show with me today is Peter Beattie, political economist at the Chinese University of Hong Kong. We continue this discussion after the break. Keep it here on Beyond the Ballot Box, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Beyond the Ballot Box. I'm Dashrin Johan, and on the show with me today is Assistant Professor Peter Beattie. He's a political economist at the Chinese University of Hong Kong. He's also the author of Social Evolution, Political Psychology, and the Media in Democracy, which is what we are discussing today. This conversation will also be available as podcasts. You can look up Beyond the Ballot Box on the BFM app, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts from. If you are listening to this on Spotify, do give us a follow and drop us a review. It would be really, really helpful. So, Peter, do you think that one of the biggest mistakes many media companies made as we shifted towards the digital and internet era is becoming free? And what I mean by that is, obviously, even when we go back to the 70s, 80s, 90s, you know, people relied on newspapers. Even in these newspapers were commercial. They had advertisements in it. They may have big billionaires owning them and things like that. But there was also the element of you need to go to the store and pay, like, okay, let's say in Malaysia, I don't know, maybe in the 70s, it could be 50 cents or something. When I was growing up, it was like one ringgit, 50 cents. You know, and was there that element of shared stakeholders in the sense that, of course, these big companies and they are, you know, if a big car company advertises in the newspaper, they are bringing huge chunks of cash and revenue for the organization. But people are also bringing in revenue for the organization. So the organization had to then, you know, calculate like, okay, you know, I still have to answer to my readers. They are paying my salaries. I'm wondering if, as when they shifted towards the internet, where more companies, instead of straight away adapting and going to the paywall method, that means it's the same thing as going to the store and paying, but now you just pay digitally. Instead, many companies just switched to free information. Do you think that made things worse? Because now, essentially, readers are not paying the salaries of anybody working in the media anymore.
I think in some instances that could very well be the case. You know, the shift to a more kind of clickbaity journalistic style to just attract eyeballs, and you're not really so much worried about a core subscriber base. But to me, that's not really the core of the issue. The kind of the commercial biases that enter a media system because your media system is overwhelmingly commercialized, it can come just as well by having a paid subscriber base. instead of worrying about individual eyeballs being lowered so your ad rates go down, you worry very similarly about losing subscribers by offending them, by presenting them with an argument that challenges their beliefs.
Right.
But I think the real most important question when we're talking about political economy of media and the digital era is that essentially the internet has created, has turned the news and turned journalism into a public good. And what I mean by that is public goods are a kind of class of goods and services that are characterized by two key aspects. One of them is that the unit cost, the cost of producing one extra unit, is essentially zero. And the other thing is that your consumption of a public good doesn't take away my ability to consume the same public good.
Right.
And so you can think of this in all sorts of areas that we all recognize as public goods, like universal education, et cetera. But to illustrate in the realm of journalism in the digital era, you know, in the, say, 1980s or 1970s, the unit cost of producing an extra newspaper, an extra magazine, is close to zero, but considerably non-zero. There is actual physical newsprint that needs to be produced. There's also costs in the form of store shelf space for one extra copy of a newspaper, one extra magazine. And back then, the consumption of the news was so-called rivalrous. That is, if I buy a magazine from a store, that means there's one fewer magazine that you can possibly buy. If I buy the last one, you're not able to read the magazine. Now, in the internet era, both of these conditions have changed radically. The unit cost of one extra person reading a newspaper article or reading a listening or watching a news video online is effectively zero. There's a slight cost for server space, bandwidth, electricity to run your computer, but it's effectively zero. The other aspect is rivalrousness. It's non-rivalrous. If I read a New York Times article, that does not take away anything from your ability to read that same news article. So we're in a realm now where the news, journalism, is effectively a public good, if you look at those two core characteristics, but we're not treating it in economic policy like a public good, because public goods, that class of goods and services, even a neoclassical economist will tell you that those are best provided by government, not by the private market. But instead, we're keeping the old model of private ownership of and private funding of journalism, even though the nature of journalism has shifted into that of a public good. And I think that really is what is at the core of all of these problems, from, you know, newspapers going under and stopping their print runs, newspapers closing down entirely, fewer people actually being hired to do the full-time work of journalism. The, you know, competition over competition with search engines and social media sites for ad revenue. All of this can be rooted or traced back to the fact that in the internet era, journalism is a public good, but we're not treating it like one in terms of our economic policy.
If I want to understand one of your critiques accurately that you brought up in your book, is that you critique the rational ideal of the human mind promoted by liberal theorists. And you say that it fails to accurately portray human beings realistically. What do you mean by this?
So if you go back to kind of like the Enlightenment era liberal theory, the idea, and I mean, I completely agree with this, the idea is that people can self-govern, that we don't need a class of aristocrats and kings and dukes and duchesses and all that nonsense to govern us, because the human mind is such that it's capable of self-government. We are able to learn about the world, learn about competing policies, deliberate amongst each other, and come to a shared agreement. And in that process, we can successfully self-govern. Now, like I said, you know, I'm certainly in agreement with that argument as against the classical conservatives who are arguing that we actually do need an aristocracy and kings and monarchs, et cetera, because they are such that you know, they have superior reasoning, superior education, et cetera. We need that class to govern us. Obviously, I'm on the side of the liberals there. The key problem is that if you assume too much into our ability to reason according to an abstract ideal, you miss the massive range of biases that are operating in our real human minds that bring real human minds quite far afield from the kind of liberal rational ideal. And so I go into that a lot in the book. There's an enormous amount of biases that have been studied by social psychologists. I'll just bring up one as an example. In my opinion, it's probably the most important one, and that is intergroup bias, mm-hmm. that we have this innate ability and tendency to think of other people as members of groups, and then members of our in-groups, the groups that we are members of, we tend to think more highly of people in our groups than people outside of our groups. And this is a kind of multi-purpose kind of groove in our brains that can be filled in with all sorts of things, from political partisanship to sports team fandom to ideological differences to, you know, religious differences, et cetera. All of this is implicated in intergroup bias. What it means, or to show you how this conflicts with the kind of liberal rational ideal, the liberal rational ideal would say, it doesn't make any fundamental difference whether I was born to parents in Malaysia or the US. I should still be able to think cool-headedly and rationally about the costs and benefits of various policies without irrationally privileging members of my in-group over my out-group. Because rationally, I can recognize that it was just a pure historical accident that I was born in one part of the planet rather than another part of the planet. But of course, that's just not how our brains work. And more perniciously, intergroup bias is operating without our conscious awareness. In how it feels like to think, it seems like we're being perfectly rational as we think about questions that involve groups, as we think about questions that involve nations, international politics, but that's not how our brains are actually functioning. All the time, our brains are functioning to give a preference to member of our national in-group and less preference to out-group members, to people of other nations. And again, like I said, that's just one tiny example. There's a whole range of biases that are operating in our minds at all times that, because our media systems are not designed to deal with real human minds, and they're essentially assuming in the structure of the media system that we have these idealized liberal rational minds, you've got a huge amount of problems that arise from that mismatch just in itself. And to just give an example to illustrate, you know, what that liberal idealized rational mind would do, if you had that idealized liberal rational mind and you look at the U.S. media system, what would you do? Well, you turn on Fox and you would think to yourself, OK, this is a media outlet that is owned by a right-wing Australian billionaire. He has his own ideology that's very much in favor of, you know, maximum freedom to people who own the economy, minimum freedom of the people to use their government to, and, you know, enact laws that would constrain the owners of the economy, and so on and so forth. You think of all of the biases just from the ownership of the company. Then you would go and say, ah, and plus we're dealing with a commercialized media system here. So all Fox outlets are thinking, okay, we can't annoy or anger our audience because then we're going to lose eyeballs to sell to advertisers. So you'd be constantly thinking at every time you're watching Fox, all of these qualifications and how you should interpret the information you're getting, and you would basically discount the arguments made in Fox by all of the political, economic, and psychological reasons why you would expect bias. Now, it's taken me already like 5 minutes to describe this basic process for one media outlet. But of course, that's simply not the way our brains work. We're not constantly making all of these ideal rational qualifications to the arguments we perceive. And that's really the fundamental disconnect here, is that our actual brains are nowhere like the liberal rational ideal that was formulated before we really knew much about psychology.
So if US is a bad example, if the US media landscape is a bad example, what is there any countries right now which have better media landscapes?
Well, I mean, even sticking to the US, there used to be this policy called the Fairness Doctrine that the FCC would enforce to some extent at least. And the idea was that if you're going to have an argument on one side of a contentious issue, you need to give some sort of right of reply to people who adhere to the other side. That's kind of the core requirement, I think, of a democratic or a democracy appropriate media system, is ensuring that users of that media system are not denied the opportunity to learn all sides of an issue and make up their own mind versus just getting one or maybe two sides of an issue and then being kept ignorant of a multitude of other perspectives. But the US doesn't have many good examples of democracy appropriate media policies. For that, you'd have to go to Europe, particularly a lot of Northern European countries at various parts of their recent history had much better policies to foster internal diversity. I think of the Dutch media system, which for a while had guaranteed media time for the major sectors in society. I think they call them the pillars. So you would have one that represents the Protestant part of the population, one that represents the Catholic part, one that represents more socialist ideas, one that represents a more pro-capitalist perspective. There are a number of examples I go over in my book of media policies that actually do foster the kind of internal diversity that's required for a democracy appropriate media system. And when I say internal diversity, I'm talking about ideological diversity within outlets. Because you can look at the US media system even and say, oh, there's actually lots of diversity. If you want to get a center-right perspective, go to the Washington Post. If you want to get a far-right perspective, go to Fox. If you want a left-wing perspective, you're perfectly free to subscribe to Monthly Review or Jacobin or something. It does exist there, and on the internet, there are even more options. But that describes a media system with external diversity, meaning that within the system overall, you can find proponents of a wide variety of different ideological perspectives. But the reason why that's insufficient to produce a democracy-appropriate media system is that normal people simply do not have the time to create on their own an ideologically diverse media diet. That takes hours and hours every day, maybe every week at least. But normal people just don't do that. They're busy with their lives. You need to have mass outlets that internal to each outlet, you have ideological diversity so that the majority of the population that isn't they aren't political junkies like us who find intrinsic pleasure in seeking out different political arguments, so that normal people just tuning into the news at the end of a long day of work for an hour or maybe even half an hour, they can get exposure to the full range of perspectives and really understand the debate so that it can be accurately said that they are choosing for themselves the opinions and the policies that they want. If you don't have that, you have what the arch conservative G.K. Chesterton said. He said that the blackest of lies is not even a half truth. The blackest of lies is fully true. The what makes it a black lie is that it's a truth that's presented in isolation from other truths, that if you are exposed to both the first truth and the truth surrounding it, would result in a completely different understanding. But if you're able to just pick only those truths that you want people to know so as to mislead them, he said, that's the worst form of lying. And that is a really great way of characterizing how the US media system operates.
I picked up a couple of things you said just now, right? And the first thing you I think you stressed a number of times about diversity, but you said you need two sides or all the sides of a particular issue, or we need various ideologies. And I think that's an interesting thing you brought up, because sometimes when people think two sides or different sides, they're just thinking about political parties.
Right.
So what is the difference between presenting two sides of an argument and another versus saying getting Joe Biden and Trump and saying I have two sides, or just someone from the Democrats and someone from the Republicans, for example, using US as an example, and saying, see, I do this regularly, I do have both sides of the argument?
Right. There's actually a journalist from Texas who put it the best way. I forget how she put it exactly, but it was something like, you know, we don't actually get the diversity we need if you have one side saying that there's a cat in the bushes over there and the other side saying, no, it's a dog, when in reality, there's an elephant in the bushes. You know, I think that expresses it pretty well. But you know, that's kind of the evil genius without any sort of evil genius creating it in the U.S. media system, that you have the appearance of diversity and you know, vibrant debate when you have two positions that are rather close to each other on a real ideological spectrum, on a global ideological spectrum, and those are really the only two perspectives you get. Because then it seems to most people like really the scope of the ideological spectrum is from the Democrats to the Republicans. And everything outside of that spectrum is just unknown, or if it's known at all, it's very poorly known, and it's very easy to just hand wave it away because it doesn't seem to have any real purchase on public opinion. And of course, it doesn't have very much purchase on public opinion because nobody really gets to see it. Nobody gets to understand the arguments, to learn the evidence behind the arguments about why, you know, a policy that neither the Democratic nor the Republican Party supports, why that policy might actually be a good idea. So it's this kind of false diversity of showing just two very ideologically similar on a full ideological spectrum positions. That's the danger of that system.
And before we wrap this conversation up, would you have some closing thoughts about your book, about the media, where we go from here?
Well, the media is really at the root of all of our problems. You know, if you talk to political activists, probably all across the spectrum, you'll probably hear people say things like, you know, why won't the people wake up? The people should know this, and they should overthrow a system or a policy or a politician that isn't acting in their interest. Why won't people wake up? And the problem there is that people don't wake up after reading, you know, hundreds or thousands of pages of political argumentation and evidence in their sleep. You need information in order to arrive at certain positions. If you lack that information, then there's no reason to support a policy that you don't know of in the first place. So really, to me, the core problem around the world, whether it's, you know, the ecological crisis, whether it's the rise of right-wing populism or perhaps neo-fascism, the core problem are democracy inappropriate media systems, which have only really gotten worse. You know, I was a little optimistic when my book came out. I was putting the finishing touches during the Trumpocene, you know, the Trump era in the U.S. And all of a sudden you had at least, you know, a big part of the population wondering, how could this charlatan win an election? What is going on in the minds of these other people? I thought, well, okay, now finally people, a large number of people are going to recognize the power of the media and the importance of media reform so that we create democracy-appropriate media systems. Not media systems in which, you know, Trumpist messages don't appear at all, but media systems in which Trumpist messages appear alongside critiques of them from the kind of center-right Democrats all the way to the actual left. But that's not what we have. So to me, the core takeaway is that whatever problem is paramount for you in the world today, you can always trace it back to a lack of widespread political awareness about the problem. You, the individual activist who's concerned about, you know, animal mistreatment in factory farms, or, you know, the ecological crisis more broadly, climate change in particular, the rise of neo-fascism, whatever, you recognize these as problems because you spent time to learn about those problems. You've absorbed a lot of information about that. And one last psychological bias that's important to keep in mind in this context is called the curse of knowledge, that our brains are very bad at understanding how other people think who don't know what we know. That is, as we learn new information, our kind of default setting in our minds is to assume that we now are finally catching up to the level of the understanding that everyone else had. And whereas we were ignorant before, everyone else knew this before. Of course, that's just not how it operates. Our minds blind us to the reality. And it's very easy to forget that we didn't always have the political concerns that we have today. We had to first learn about a political problem and then learn about various solutions. Well, that is at the root of all political problems we face, is that you just don't have enough people who have absorbed the same information that political activists have absorbed. That information is what made them activists in the first place. If you had democracy appropriate media systems around the world, at the very least, you could rest assured that the rest of the population has a basic awareness of the problem and a basic awareness of the different policies that could be used to solve the problem. And then maybe you could say, well, the problem is with the people because they're rejecting the proposed solution. But until you get past that base level impediment of ignorance, you can't really blame the people. You have to blame the providers of information that have kept the people ignorant so that they don't even know of the existence of the problem in the first place, the extent of the problem, or the policy options to solve it.
Peter, on that note, thank you so much for joining me today.
My pleasure, Dasha. Until next time.
That was Assistant Professor Peter Beattie, political economist at the Chinese University of Hong Kong. And I'm Dashrin Johan, and this has been Beyond the Ballot Box, BFM 89.9.
You have been listening to a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station. For more stories of the same kind, download the BFM app.